The next case on calendar this morning is Gunderson v. D.R. Horton, case number 56614. Is counsel ready to proceed?
Yes.
Please do so. Oh, yes. Before we get underway, Justice Seda has really a question more than a disclosure.
I have some concern based on the age of this case as to whether or not at any point in time when I was a district judge I may have touched this case. It does not appear from our records that I did, and I see no reason to disqualify myself on this case, but I wanted to be sure that all of you knew that I was cognizant of the age and the time of this case, and if anyone knew of any reason why I should not sit on it, I would be happy to consider that.
I do not believe that you touched this case, Justice Seda. It went from Justice, then Judge Cherry, directly over to Department 22 and Judge Johnson.
And so to the best of your knowledge, there was no settlement conference, no early case intervention, anything that I may have. It is not familiar to me. It's just an abundance of caution.
I'm pretty confident there was no MSC that you were involved in this case.
And Bruno Wolfens for D.R. Horton, I do not recall you being involved in this case.
Thank you, counsel.
Very well. Are counsel ready to proceed?
Yes.
Jim Christensen on behalf of appellants. May it please the court, this is an appeal that's been brought from a jury verdict and a denial of a motion for new trial and a motion for additor from the district court. There are a number of issues.
Before you get underway, could you tell us who you represent?
I represent those individuals listed in the notice of appearance that I filed in February of this year. There are 20 individuals listed. There is another person who called me up in the past week and signed a fee agreement. And if the instructions to my office this morning were followed, there should be another supplemental notice of appearance filed this morning on behalf of Shauna Mayfield. So there are 21 of the 39 that went to trial that I represent. And I handed a copy of my notice of appearance to Mr. Wolfenson before we got started today, and he acknowledged it and has seen it.
Thank you.
So have the other appellants abandoned?
I do not know. Some of these folks have literally passed on. Some of them have moved. There was one individual I chose not to represent. Some of these folks didn't respond to queries from the office, so I can't really speak to it. Okay. I do represent 21. The remainder, I do not represent them. If I could reserve 5 minutes for a rebuttal. And the first issue I'd like to get into is the exclusion of evidence, specifically the response to the defect list and the report of repairs, which were Exhibit 334 and 335, respectively. These were documents that presented a detailed listing of the defects and what D.R. Horton promised to do in response to those defects prior to their beginning repairs. Exhibit 335 was the report of repairs, which was provided pursuant to statute, NRS 40.648 sub 5, that details the repairs that D.R. Horton allegedly did. The response to the defect list was provided approximately 8 months after the service of the homeowner's initial notice of defects, and repairs went on in an elongated process. The report of repairs was provided several days after the district court lifted stay and the case was proceeding in litigation. At the trial of this matter, the homeowners presented testimony from an architect, a plumber, a structural engineer, an electrician. They had a person who specialized in mold, and we also presented testimony of a cost estimator who put a cost onto the repairs that the previous experts had testified to. In response, D.R. Horton did not put on their architect, they did not put on their plumber, they did not put on their electrician, they did not put on their cost estimator. They put on their structural engineer, who changed his disclosed testimony prior to trial. And they put on a Mr. Grill, who prepared the response to the defect list. He was not disclosed as an expert prior to trial. However, he morphed into an expert in the middle of trial. D.R. Horton defended the case on the premise that they had repaired everything. And the homeowner response was, no, you didn't. There's a lot of things you didn't repair, and there's a lot of things that you didn't repair correctly. So the homeowners put on a wealth of evidence through their experts concerning what was done and what was not done. And we also sought to put on evidence of what was done and what was not done in the form of Exhibits 334 and 335. Mr. Grill testified at trial that he had actually gone beyond the scope of his response to the defects, Exhibit 334, and had even made more repairs. That testimony was not supported by Exhibit 335, which was the report of repairs. In other words, D.R. Horton was claiming at trial, contrary to the disclosed opinions of its experts prior to trial, that it had done a lot more work and that certain defects were no longer remaining. I sought to introduce the report of repairs, and it was excluded. The response to the defect list was also excluded. And the court excluded those two documents on the basis that it read an error of law. It read into Chapter 40 an explicit privilege. It said you cannot use Exhibit 334 and 335, even though they're relevant, because of privilege. And it read into Chapter 40 privilege, which does not exist. We know that the law in Nevada is that privileges have to be narrowly construed.
Counsel, though, with, in all fairness, though, the context you're placing this in, normally that privilege you're speaking of goes to the Chapter 40 mediation, pretrial mediation,
correct,
that I understand did not occur. However, if I'm correct, that mediation occurred after the filing of the complaint or sometime thereafter.
In the normal course of events in the litigation, a mediator was eventually appointed pursuant to the CMO. Some preliminary efforts were done in that mediation. It never really led anywhere. Then our initial mediator passed away. Frankly, it didn't really go very far after that. But that leads to an excellent point, Justice Douglas, which is, what is the scope of a mediation? Chapter 40 has 40.680, which talks about a mediation. That never occurred. We didn't.
That raised below, counsel?
Pardon?
Did you raise that issue below?
I'm sorry.
Did you raise that issue below?
Yes.
Okay.
I argued that extensively. And then that gets us into what is a mediation and how far does mediation privilege go in Nevada. Mediation privilege goes in Nevada as far as what is actually exchanged in the mediation. To compare, in the supplemental authorities provided by D.R. Horton recently, they provided the California right to repair statute, which is different in a couple of interesting respects. First of all, in California, a homeowner has a right to reject an offer of repair, something homeowners don't have in this state. In fact, some of the homeowners attempted to reject D.R. Horton's very offer of repair in this case, and Justice Cherry denied that attempt, correctly, because the statute doesn't allow for it. California does. But the real difference is, under the California Evidence Code, Section 1119, is it's broader than Nevada's mediation privilege. It talks about documents that are submitted prior to or leading up to a mediation. It encompasses a lot more information than Nevada's. So the California legislature decided it wanted response reports to be used at trial, so they crafted a specific exception. The other side of that coin is Arizona and Florida, also statutes submitted by D.R. Horton and their supplemental authorities. In those jurisdictions, they have a narrower interpretation of a mediation privilege, and those statutes specifically, explicitly state that the response to a notice of defects is privileged and can't be used in a courtroom. And that's exactly what the homeowners are saying in this case. If the legislature of Nevada wanted to exclude these documents from use in a courtroom, they would have said so. It's basic statutory interpretation. That's exactly what Arizona and Florida did. California took a different tact, and they took it exactly because their mediation privilege is broader than Nevada's. So when the trial judge expanded the mediation privilege and excluded those two documents, he committed legal error. And it had a prejudicial effect upon the homeowners because the homeowners put on a wealth of evidence. It was, at a minimum, a closely contested case. It can be fairly argued that the evidence on the part of the homeowners was quite a bit stronger than that presented by Deer Horton and the subcontractors. They didn't even present three-quarters of their retained experts, probably because in pretrial disclosures, those three-quarters of experts agreed to a certain number of defects and agreed certain things had to be repaired. And that did not comport with the zero-defect defense Deer Horton elected to pursue at trial. There's another document that was excluded in error from evidence. Oh, excuse me, I didn't get very far. Thank you.
Good morning. Bruno Wolfenson on behalf of D.R. Horton. May it please the court, and I hope that's not taken as a statement of personal sympathies. But this case and the issues presented on appeal are all created by the appellants. The problem was the alleged defects they went to trial on were all fixed. There's a history to this case. The attorneys were originally hired by the Homeowners Association. Experts were sent out to look at the entirety of the project rather than individual units. When D.R. Horton came out and did fixes, they repaired all of the items that were being complained of. The Homeowners Association fired their attorneys. There was no reason to go on to litigation. The attorneys brought a suit on behalf of 39 individuals with the same experts who never bothered to go out there and look at the repairs. So the trial went something like this. Mr. Electrician for the plaintiffs, did you have a problem with the can lighting? Yes. What was that problem? Well, the stucco guy that came by, he oversprayed the materials that he uses to give texture. And that shouldn't be in the can lights. Oh, okay. D.R. Horton, what did you do about that? Well, we wiped the material out of there. We cleaned it out. Mr. Plaintiff, electrician, what's wrong with that? Well, they should have given us new can lights. Well, that's not what you said in your initial report. You just complained about the material being in there. And the jury didn't buy that. And there was no reason to bring experts to battle those sorts of allegations that were already fixed.
So then the exclusion of evidence that the appellant is complaining of does not cross over into the subtle differences between the statutory scheme in our geographically similar California, Arizona, Utah. I mean, Nevada is a right to repair state.
Yes.
California isn't. Okay?
Right.
So what you're saying is that it was still okay to use bits and pieces of California law to show the jury? I'm having a hard time posing the question, obviously. But I'm deeply concerned about that. That subtle difference is important in terms of what goes to a jury in these cases.
I understand that. And the reason other state laws were provided to the court was so that you can see the differences, how that is handled. I will admit that our statute is somewhat silent on whether these documents are actually privileged or not privileged. Now, it'd be really nice if the court had those documents so you could actually look and see what did they say? Was it a prejudice? Were they privileged? How were they stamped? But the appellants failed to provide you a complete record. And under Cousy, they lose. That was that policeman case where they didn't marshal all the evidence. Why didn't they bring that in front of you? If those reports are so important and were so prejudicial to keep out, why isn't that in front of the court? This court can't make that decision. They neglected to do that. So, the problems are created by them. The toilets, I don't know if all of the justices have looked at the pictures that were included with the reply. Horrible pictures of underneath the toilets where water was, right? Tugs at your heartstrings. Oh, my God, that's terrible. D.R. Horton should pay for that. D.R. Horton fixed all of those. By the way, one of those toilets comes from a house that is not being represented by Mr. Christensen, the Rodriguez home. Appellant's appendix 194-87. Four of those, Mr. Kreitenberg agreed were fixed after those photos were taken. So you're not even looking at the situation that existed at the time of trial. That was the problem that the jury had. This has all been fixed. There's one in there for Minicelli. Appellant's appendix 194, 92, and 93. That toilet wasn't even listed in Exhibit 118, which was Mr. Kreitenberg's exhibit of which toilets had to be fixed. They didn't even recommend that one to be
fixed. Mr. Wilkins, what did the jury award? It was $66,300. So obviously there was something there, the jury concluded. What was the basis of the verdict award?
The basis of the verdict award was the fact that there were cleanouts for these triplexes. And the way the cleanouts work, you have, I'll call them primary, secondary, and the last final cleanout in these houses. So you have cleanouts in near your sinks, halfway down the hall, and then eventually outside. The ones that are eventually outside were actually placed in the garages, and actually in one garage of the three garages that fed these family homes. The reason that was done was because the building inspector said, we don't want you putting the cleanouts out on the street because these streets may be dedicated to us and we don't want to have to pave and maintain around those little cleanouts. It's a roll-up curb right into the garage, so there is no driveway really, so you can't put them out in the driveways. Put it in the garage. We said, okay. We weren't allowed to present that testimony at trial because Judge Corey said, we're not going to get into what a building inspector says or doesn't say, because plaintiffs are bringing a code violation case. Their case was always code violation. At the very end, they changed their theory of the case. And what I mean by that is they had warranty claims, they had implied warranty claims, contractual sounding claims throughout the case, meaning, is this a code violation? If it is, you breach your contract by not providing me, or you breach your warranty by not providing me what a code-compliant house would otherwise be. At the very end, they said, we're going forward on a negligence theory. Well, as this court and all of you know, on a negligence theory, when you use breach of a statute, whether it's speeding or code violation, now you're looking at my behavior, the defendant's behavior. What did I do wrong? And when you're telling me that I violated the statute, then I get to argue excuse or justification. Well, Judge Corey, let me argue excuse or justification that I met with building inspectors, but it was too late because now we're arguing about jury instructions and we're arguing, you know, to the jury in 2 days. So there was no chance to bring anybody back. Now, there was some excuse and justification evidence because we had talked to subcontractors who were the experts on plumbing, and we had said, what do you think? Where should we put these things? And that was the basis of the award, was that the jury found that D.R. Horton never fixed those cleanouts because we didn't think it was a violation. We had done what the building inspector on that project. It told us to do. We didn't think they needed to be moved or anything else.
Let me ask you, if I can jump ahead, because I know we've got a lot of issues here.
Yes.
The offer of judgment issue and your cross appeal and all. My understanding, you made an offer of judgment, $2,000 per plaintiff before the trial. The verdict came back $66,300. Was it broken down in special verdicts, you know, per plaintiff, or how did that come to pass?
It was. We actually have 39 different verdicts, so we didn't have to do any division or any complex.
So all the verdicts, when they divided out, were less than $2,000 per plaintiff then?
Right, and you didn't have to divide it out because we actually had a verdict for Plaintiff A, and we had an actual offer of judgment to Plaintiff A.
Okay.
So those were. It was easy to calculate. And we specifically made the decision as D.R. Horton to not include in that offer a number for attorney fees and costs. But we did say you get those things when you apply to the court, as statute 440.655 allows you to do, because they have to be approved by the court. So we did make those individual offers.
As that offer segues into the next series of issues, and that's attorney's fees for the homeowners, the appropriateness and non-appropriateness, but more importantly, your request for attorney's fees and costs as it so relates. And the other segue that you got out of in terms of proof, the issue as to the non-use or the inability to put forth one of your experts,
right,
which you raised as it affected the verdict.
Right. So I was hoping to do that on my reserve time, but I'll address it here. On the issue of our right to attorney fees, and I think that's what you're asking about, is we are saying that we beat the offers of judgment that we made to each individual, that we are allowed, may, under the code, receive attorney fees, that the judge did, Judge Corey did a weighing of the Beattie factors. We don't think that by failing one of the factors we're completely eliminated. That's just used as a governor as to which of the, how much attorney fees are you going to get, what's reasonable, what are you entitled to. And that's what we're saying, that we beat the offers of judgment. They were Judge Corey found that the offers were reasonable. Not only were they valid, they were reasonable. We believe that we should get some attorney fees. The mistake that Judge Corey made as a matter of law is as to costs. Costs are not a may, but under NRCP 68, they're a shall, and we should get our costs. And quite frankly, from the time we made the offer to the time of the judgment, our costs in this case were $1.99 million, whereas our fees at that point were, I think, just under $800,000. So, quite frankly, economically speaking, we're very much wanting to get our costs on that issue. You also asked, there was another item that you asked about, Justice Douglas.
Just in general, the applicability of the offer of judgment.
This court in Albios has already said the offer of judgment trumps Chapter 40, fees and costs. So that I don't think that's an intellectually novel or stimulating issue. It does. They were individual offers. We're entitled to them. We should get our costs. Now, if you do look at NRCP 68, subsection F, that actually talks about fees also being a shall. And so we should get our fees. Now, one thing that both parties did in the underlying case is we did not segregate out our fees or our costs as to the individual claimants, as to the 39 different plaintiffs in the case. It's a double standard here, and that's because we're dealing with two different statutes. Plaintiffs are under an obligation to show which fees and costs are proximately caused by a construction defect. So now that you know that the jury awarded only for the cleanouts, which is a plumbing issue, they had an obligation to identify which fees and costs were as a result of the cleanouts, the plumbing issues. Certainly they're not going to get electrical fees, Certainly they're not going to get fees for attending the deposition of the roofer. Certainly they're not going to get it for their expert who testified about structural issues. They never did that. For them, they put Judge Corey in an uncomfortable position and this court in an uncomfortable position of an all or nothing. There is no middle ground. They want it all or nothing. They don't want to be put to that. We, on the other hand, are operating under the offer of judgment rules, which talk about, if you look at 17.15.4 subsection C and NRCP 68, payment of cost, and the Schuweiler case, maybe I'm mispronouncing that one, it talks about the fact that we can recover our fees and our costs from any party. So we can lump it all together, because quite frankly, when we appeared at the deposition of the electrician, it was not just for Mr. Gunderson, it was for all of them. And under the code, we can get it from any party, as Schuweiler did. Schuweiler even, you know, one got tagged for some fees and transferred it to the other loser.
So let me understand. So based upon a $2,000 offer of judgment per plaintiff, you feel all the plaintiffs are jointly and severally liable for $2 million in costs, right?
I didn't write the laws.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. I only have 30 seconds left, so I'll reserve that little time.
Thank you. I was had to stop myself from standing up and objecting to counsel offering facts not in the record, just as he did in the trial below. There was no evidence of what a building inspector said concerning the drain cleanouts. That's something that was offered by counsel as if it was fact, just as he offered facts when he asked questions in the trial below, just as he ignored orders of the court in the trial below. There was no evidence concerning why the association fired their attorney. There was a separate litigation over that, which D.R. Horton settled, but it was certainly not for the reason espoused by counsel. There is an undeniable habit and continuing pervasive misconduct of counsel in the trial below of providing facts that were not in evidence. Those are the
Mr. Christensen, I am reading this record like there was an allegation Mr. Wolfenson said to send a message and some of these issues Leochi versus Cohen deals with, but were there objections to this based upon the criteria in Leochi and Cohen on how the opposing party has to preserve this issue?
Yes, Your Honor, there were many objections. If you would read the response brief of you may not think so. But if you read the appellant's opening brief and reply brief, we went on through and painstakingly detailed the location of the record where each objection was raised and the response. Certainly there were some instances of misconduct that were not objected to. You can't catch them all. But we caught well over 100. The first send a message comment during closing argument, I was actually about this far off my chair at the time that the judge objected and said, what do you, and stopped his closing at that point. We had a discussion about Leochi. Then defense counsel immediately returned to the same theme, and I was able to get my objection in before the judge that time. At that second objection, there was no admonishment. There wasn't an admonishment after the first one, not after the second one. You heard the discussion of the inspectors. There was a Judge Corey was very clear that we were not going to discuss alleged building inspections of defect issues. He was very clear about that. In fact, he was so clear about that that when one of the defense lawyers crossed the line in opening, we read a curative instruction to the jury. He was very clear about that in that every time that they brought that issue up and I objected or moved to strike when one of their witnesses would just volunteer it to a non-responsive offering about building inspections, I would move to strike, and that would be sustained. But it happened throughout the entire trial. The entire trial. In closing, Mr. Wolfenson was not the only one to offer evidence. Counsel for RCR got up and told the jury, I've been out there. I've looked at everything. There are no defects. And I objected. And it was sustained. And he then continued on the same theme. I objected again. And that one was overruled. In closing argument, Mr. Wolfenson was holding up the building plans that had been stamped. And he started talking about what the stamps meant. It meant, oh, they went through plan check. They went through this. They went through that. And I objected. I said, Your Honor, he's overstressing the point. The day before, trial day before, Mr. Wolfenson had told the court, I'm not going to talk about what those stamps mean. I quoted that language in our reply brief. Very next day, he was talking about it. He was offering evidence about what the Building Inspection Department does. There were no witnesses from the building department at this trial.
Mr. Christian, can I just ask you, I know there's a little bit of time left, talk about the costs and attorney's fees. Is Mr. Wolfenson right that if they beat the offer of judgment, the costs are mandatory? And what about the attorney's fees as well? Did the judge properly analyze the Beatty factors?
If I can address that issue, number one, the offers themselves were not valid because they left an open question concerning whether you are going to get fees or costs. That language was...
You may answer this question.
The language is very wishy-washy. And in fact, there was one homeowner, for reasons particular to himself, that accepted an offer, Mr. Ireland. And I actually had to file a motion and go to court to get Judge Corey to award fees and costs. And in response to that effort, D.R. Horton opposed it and said he doesn't get any fees and costs. Raised a whole list of reasons why Mr. Ireland, the one person who did accept, doesn't get fees and costs.
Did he get them?
Yes, the court granted them over the objections of D.R. Horton. And the point is this, that at the time that those offers were provided to homeowners, we looked at them and we're looking at this language on its face and we're saying, this is awfully wiggly language. It doesn't say, and you will get your fees and costs, as one would think Chapter 40 requires to make it valid, because that's part of the damage that you get under 655. You get your costs. You get your attorney's fees. So that should be included. It didn't. It left an open question. So we have homeowners who are looking at the disclosed testimony of D.R. Horton's experts saying, yes, there are certain defects that were not repaired, and we're looking at D.R. Horton's cost of repair, and we're going, well, this doesn't make any sense. So that's a good segue to jump into the Beatty factors. At the time that they were analyzed, yeah, the district court looked at it and said, well, it wasn't unreasonable to reject these offers.
Okay.
At that time, Peter Curry said, yeah.
So your argument, Chief, if I may, on the costs are they shouldn't get costs because the offer judgments are improper and how they were tendered. Assuming we disagreed with that and we haven't even left to look at that, are your clients jointly and severally liable for $2 million in costs based on the $2,000 offer of judgment under the wording of NRCP 68 and the case law?
No.
Okay.
Because the judge was correct when he denied the cost, because the costs actually date from the beginning of the case from something like June of 2004 and not from the date of the offer. And they did not, that 1.9 number is their total cost load. Not
but you agree that the costs would be mandatory under 68F1?
Pardon, Your Honor?
Do you agree that, assuming you get past the wording of the offer of judgment and that they were valid offers of judgment, do you agree with your opposing colleague that the award of costs, if not of fees, was mandatory under 68F1?
Under the offer, costs are mandatory if you properly present them
right
to the court.
Thank you.
And the point being, as the judge found, they had an opportunity to present these costs properly. The judge actually sent us off to the special master to review the costs and fees that were being claimed by both parties. They had plenty of opportunity to do it right, and they didn't do it. And we know from the case law in Nevada that you know, if you're going to ask for costs, you have requirements. Just because you may have done well under an offer and that gives you a route to recovery of them, you still have to go through a few more hoops. You have to provide receipts. You have to provide other indicia of the reasonableness of those costs. And in this case, the hoop that they did not jump through that the district court required them to was you only get costs from the date of the offer forward, and they didn't comply. So the court was right in denying costs.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And, Mr. Wilson, were the costs broken down to post-offer judgment costs, or were they all run together pre and post?
The costs were segregated out so that the court could look at them separately. The figure I gave you is for all the costs.
Okay. What was the post-offer judgment? I mean, Mr. Christensen's saying they were never broken down, so it was a mishmash that the judge denied. And he didn't, therefore, his argument is he didn't abuse his discretion in doing that. What's your response to that?
All the costs were itemized, so you could definitely tell when they were incurred, who incurred them, and the timeline. I don't have that figure in front of me at this moment.
But you say they are broken down in the record as post-offer judgment costs.
Yes.
Okay.
Yep.
Well, Mr. Wolfens, I'm disturbed by your representations earlier. You left the clear impression that you were entitled to $1.9 million under the offer of judgment ruling costs with this court not more than 15 minutes ago. You concede now that you're not entitled to $1.9 million.
I concede that we are entitled to our costs.
From the point of the offer of judgment.
From the point of the offer of judgment.
Which clearly is not $1.9 million, sir.
I don't have that figure in front of me. I don't know if that one, and I apologize for that, I don't know if that one was $1 million.
I'm not asking for the number. You've told us already that $1.9 million is the total cost in the case.
Yes, Your Honor. That's what I recall.
They're recoverable.
Yes. The total costs in the case from all of our experts.
So certainly you're not entitled to $1.9 million if the offers of judgment were made just before trial.
No, we would be entitled to a portion of those costs. But I don't have that figure with me. They were in the findings of Floyd Hale. He broke out all of the fees and all of the costs in a pre-offer, post-offer manner.
Is that part of this record?
I want to say yes.
Would you provide the record site, please? Not now, when you're done.
Yes.
Please provide it to the clerk either or by a separate pleading later in the next few days, if you would, if that's acceptable to the chief.
And we...
It is acceptable. And you may respond if you have a counter citation.
Okay.
And you're out of time, sir.
Yes. Thank you, Your Honor.
This matter will be submitted and will be in recess.